So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this special Open Access Week luncheon talk. My name is Amar Asher, and I am just going to briefly do some logistical bits and introduce Stuart and Peter, and then turn it over to them to lead the conversation. But just right before that happens, if you have not been to a Berkman Center luncheon before, we are very wired and therefore want to let you know that we are being webcast live and that this will be recorded for posterity and put on the Berkman Center's website and the Office for Scholarly Communications website as well. So please just be aware during the Q&A that you are being recorded and that this is being webcast online. And a benefit of that is that we are encouraging folks to use Twitter, both who are here in person as well as who are watching on the webcast, to ask questions. We want to make this a very discussion-oriented session, so Peter and Stuart have told me that they welcome interruptions during their framing. So please jump in with questions at any time during this conversation. Please pose them over Twitter, and we'll be monitoring that. We'll try to highlight some of the questions that come out of Twitter. So we're here this week to celebrate Open Access Week. There are a host of things going on that are being hosted both by the Office for Scholarly Communication, who is co-hosting this luncheon, as well as by the Berkman Center. This is one of those events, as well as lots of other institutions in Boston and elsewhere. To find out more information about what's going on with Open Access Week, there are links from the Berkman Center website. There's a great page on the Office for Scholarly Communications website that you can check out to see. And one event in particular that I want to point out that's happening tomorrow, actually in this room, I think. I'm not sure what time. But the Petrie Flom Center is going to host a discussion on open access and to health and health research and the NIH open access policy. Is that right, Emily or Emily? So please do check that out. That's going to be another great Open Access Week event. What else? Since we typically, when these are smaller, go around the room and introduce ourselves, I don't think that we'll do that here, but during the Q&A, if you could identify yourself before the Q&A, just so we know who you are, that would be really helpful. I mentioned Twitter, but I didn't mention the hashtag. The hashtag is #HowOA, so please use that when you are tweeting a question or a comment. And so we're pleased to welcome both Stuart Schieber and Peter Suber. Stuart is going to lead us off. Stuart is a professor of computer science here at Harvard. He is the director for the faculty director of the Office for Scholarly Communication and is on the faculty board of the Berkman Center. And Peter Suber is a pioneer in all things open access and is affiliated with the Berkman Center, with the libraries, with the Office for Scholarly Communication, as well as Spark and other open access initiative. So we're both pleased to have them lead this conversation here for Open Access Week and to help us celebrate it. So welcome.
Okay, thank you. Let me just pause for 1 second to make sure that my mic is working. Is it okay? Well, okay, good. So today's session is ostensibly on how to make your work open access, whether you're at Harvard or not. And Peter and I will be talking about this. And I'm going to concentrate on the part about if you're at Harvard. And Peter will concentrate on the part about if you're not. But first, by way of background, what do we mean by your work, and what do we mean by open access? Of course, we're talking about the results of research, and there are many different kinds of research results. There are there's kind of the raw data that you might generate. There's the analyses you make of it. There's the funder reports that you might provide to your granting agency, and you may take your research and put it through a peer review process that leads to a peer-reviewed article. All of these are aspects of your research work, but where we're concentrating is on the last of these, peer-reviewed articles, primarily because that's where the issues tend to come up and difficulties can come up in making your work open access. The other kinds of things are typically easier to make open access. And then what do I mean by open access? Well, there are many definitions of it. My favorite is the definition from the language of the Budapest Open Access Initiative, which, if I'm correct, Peter probably wrote. Is that? Yeah, I'm correct. So here's that language. It starts with free availability on the public internet, and that's really probably the most fundamental part of it, that the articles we write, we want to be as broadly available as possible, and we can take advantage of the essentially zero marginal cost of distribution on the internet to do that. But there's more in the Budapest Open Access Initiative language about permitting users not only to read and download and copy and redistribute, but also to crawl them for indexing, pass them as data to software, use them for any other lawful purpose. It's quite a broad definition, not only of the direct use of the research results in the article, but the reuse in various ways. There's an implicit assumption in the conversation we're having today, at least I hope we can make this implicit assumption, which is that you want to make your research open access. If you don't, I guess you're welcome to eat a sandwich, but I don't know why you're here. The point is, if you do want to make your research open access, how do you do it? And as I said, I'm going to handle the parochial part. That is, if you're at Harvard, what's the process here? And Peter will handle the non-parochial part because he's much less parochial than I am. Now, there's two aspects of opening access to articles that we might want to cover. The first is an issue of rights. You want to make the research freely available on the internet, allow all kinds of use and even reuse rights, and that requires a certain legal regime. And then there's an issue of mechanism. How do you go about that? Well, in the case of the rights aspect, we're in a particularly good position for faculty members in particular at Harvard, or at least almost all of the schools at Harvard, because 7 of the 9 schools at Harvard have passed open access policies that, in part, deal directly with this rights issue. So for certain faculty, that is the faculty at these 7 schools, rights are being retained by the faculty in all of our scholarly articles unless the author expressly opts out of that arrangement. And the rights are quite broad. So the technique of facilitating this rights retention is this language from, or this is actually a paraphrase from the open access policies. Faculty members grant a non-exclusive license to exercise extremely broad set of rights, essentially all rights under a non-commercial limitation. So this non-exclusive license is granted to the university as a kind of a holding site, a staging area for the rights, and I'll come back to that in a second. But it's a very broad set of rights, exercising all rights under copyright, provided the articles aren't sold. You can't sell the articles, but you can give them away, and you can use them in all these kinds of ways that I talked about before. And it's a transferable right. You can authorize the non-exclusive license to the university is a license that allows the licensee to authorize others, including the authors of the article themselves, to have all of these broad rights. So now you might ask, why would you want to authorize the authors to have these rights? It's the authors that started with the rights. The problem comes, of course, if the authors give up the rights, perhaps by transferring them to a publisher. So what would happen in that case? The university would have this non-exclusive license. The author would transfer the rights to the publisher. But the university could transfer them back. At least the subset that fall under this non-exclusive license could be transferred back or licensed back to the author. So the author, him or herself, will retain these same broad rights, exercising all of copyright so long as the articles aren't sold. So the upshot is that the kind of the normal course of events, authors retain this very broad right, set of rights, and so does the university, allowing the university to distribute the articles on behalf of the author as well. Now, I mentioned there's an opt-out provision. I don't have the language up here, but there's a specification in the policy that says if for any reason a faculty member who falls under this policy doesn't want the university to have the license that's indicated here, they can direct that a waiver of that license be granted for any reason. There's no vetting of the reasons. It's the sole discretion of the author. So the choice still stays with the author whether to retain rights or not. It's just that the default changes. Instead of having to opt in to retain rights by negotiating with the publisher, you are automatically retaining rights because of this mechanism of staging the rights in the university, unless you expressly opt out. And we've seen, not too surprisingly, that the opt-out rate is quite low. So the right situation, and again, emphasis, this is just for faculty at 7 of the 9 schools at Harvard, the right situation is really great. Automatic rights retention, the ideal action that an author would take is inaction. If you do nothing, you retain the broadest set of rights. And getting faculty to do nothing is a lot easier than getting them to do something. I have learned that lesson repeatedly over the last couple decades of my time here on the faculty. Now, what about the rest of the members of the Harvard community? That reduces to the essentially to the non-Harvard case, the non-parochial case, C. Peter Suber's part. Okay, so that's rights. What about mechanism for people at Harvard? So the simplest mechanism for distributing, if you happen to be at Harvard, is through Harvard's own repository. Harvard has a repository that allows distribution of articles openly to the entire world. It's called DASH, for Digital Access to Scholarship at Harvard. It serves as the distribution mechanism for Harvard-authored scholarly articles under this open access policy, but also articles that don't fall under the policy, and other kinds of works can be distributed through the repository. So the front page of DASH has some featured works, has a search functionality, lists the most downloaded works from the last week. There, we've discovered some kind of law of nature that there always seems to be at least one article about Kant on the most downloaded works every week. Anyone who can explain why that is?
Same author?
No, it's not the same author, is it? Well, this one is, but sometimes I think we've had more than one, and they haven't all been Christine Korsgaard. So here's an example of a typical page describing an article. This is an article on workplace wellness programs. This particular article happens to have been downloaded something like 500 times in the last week. Some of these articles really get a lot of usage. There are, I think, approaching about 9,000 articles in DASH, which have been downloaded well over 1 million times since the repository opened in the 2009-2010 academic year. And we're currently receiving something like, it's been steady growth in downloads, you can see here, and we're currently receiving something like 2,000 to 3,000 downloads a day of the articles in DASH. So it's not an idle issue making your work open access. If you put your work out in a repository such as this, people will read it. In fact, I dare say they're more likely to read it if you put a copy here than if you have a copy in a journal, where you have to be a subscriber or be willing to type in a credit card number and have it charged $35. So here, anyone can read it anywhere in the world. And in fact, we get downloads from across the world. Here's a map of the downloads from Dash. And you can see it covers essentially every country in the world. We're missing a few areas. Turns out these two countries in Africa, Central African Republic and I used to know the other one, South Sudan, I think, have not downloaded any articles from Dash. And as you can see up in the corner here, the island of Svalbard, we have no downloads from the island of Svalbard. But we do have, it's not on the map, but we do have a download from Antarctica. So every continent is represented, including Antarctica. McMurdo Station. Had to take a trip down there myself, but by God, we got a download from Antarctica. No, it was not me. It was, do you know who it was? Who knows? Somebody in Antarctica. How many people can there be there? I don't know. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about. There's the open access policies at Harvard that make the Harvard situation distinctive, and there's the Dash repository that make the Harvard situation distinctive. What if you're not at Harvard? Well, first of all, you may be at a place with respect to rights with a similar policy. The Harvard policies have been emulated at other places throughout the world. Now there's a few dozen institutions that have similar policies. And that number is increasing. We're talking to people, Peter especially, talking to universities throughout the world about establishing policies and doing so in the right way so that the policies really work the best. If you're not at a place that has a similar policy, you may want to support a similar policy at your place of research. And we provide a model open access policy that incorporates everything we've learned from the process of rolling out these open access policies now, having votes in 7 of the 9 schools at Harvard, and as we continue to work with the remaining 2 schools. Using insights that we've gleaned from other universities that have passed policies and incorporating language changes that have been salutary from there as well. And we, this model policy is annotated so that it explains exactly why the language is the way it is and what the changes were, you know, the motivation behind all of these changes. So that's another possibility. And in any case, if you're not at Harvard, you may want to heed Peter. So Peter is now going to talk about this more general question of how to make your work open access if you're not specifically at Harvard.
Thanks, Stuart. Heed me anyway. Does my mic work? Sorry, I'll just take off. We didn't coordinate, but I'm going to start roughly where he started and end roughly where he started. This isn't working. I'll just use... Oh, there we go. This is what I'm not talking about. There are lots of ways in which you distribute your research, and I do want to focus on peer-reviewed research articles for the reasons Stuart mentioned. They are more difficult. We can talk about why, but for now, let's just accept that I'll talk about them. But during the discussion period, we can talk about distributing your other kinds of research openly, if you'd like to. There are basically 2 ways to make your research articles open. You can publish them in an open access journal, or you can deposit them in an open access repository like Dash. I'll talk about them separately. There's a delay on this key, Dan. Or should I use this instead? Do I have to use the mouse click? Okay, good. Okay, you don't have to know the jargon, but if you read about open access, you ought to know it just so you can understand what you're reading. Publishing in an open access journal is called Gold Open Access. It's not self-explanatory. I apologize about that, but it's the term that people have come to use. To publish in an open access journal, the first step is to find one. in your field that you think is good enough for your purposes. If you go to the directory of open access journals, you can browse by field. That's what I recommend. No matter what your field is, you will find at least one open access journal, peer-reviewed open access journal, that you might consider. If you find a large number, then look closely because they will differ in ways that should matter to you. They will differ in quality, they will differ in prestige. Some of them you will have heard of, some of them you will not have heard of. Some of them are more open than others. Some of them are merely free of charge. They're not more free than that. That is, they're under all rights reserved copyrights. If you want journals that also use open licenses in addition to providing the material free of charge, some journals do that, some journals don't. You'd like to think that all open access journals do, but unfortunately, not all of them do. Look for that detail if it matters to you. Open access journals pay their bills in different ways. About 30% of them pay their bills by charging a fee on the author side. They can't charge the reader side or they wouldn't be open. So they charge to the author side. It doesn't have to come out of the author's pocket. In fact, worldwide, only about 12% of journals that charge author side fees end up getting those fees paid by authors out of pocket. Most of the time, those fees are paid by the author's employer or by the author's funding agency when the research was funded. But if you go browsing and you find a journal that looks promising and you discover that it charges a fee, don't panic. First of all, the existence of a fee does not mean that it's a vanity publishing journal. These are all peer-reviewed. I should have mentioned that all the journals listed in the Directory of Open Access Journals are peer-reviewed. Nothing that conducts peer review should be considered vanity publishing. This is a way to pay the bills, and the fee is not charged until the paper passes peer review, and the editors and the referees who conduct peer review don't even know whether or not the author is being offered a waiver. Many journals that charge fees will waive them in cases of economic hardship, and as I said, the editors don't know whether you've requested a waiver. They don't know whether accepting your paper will bring revenue or bring expense to the journal. If your journal charges a fee and if you are not eager to pay it out of pocket, check with your funding agency if your research was funded. A growing number of funding agencies will pay these fees on behalf of their grantees. If it's not funded or if your funder won't pay, check your institution to see whether it will pay. Harvard has a fund that will pay. Footnote, it'll only pay if you're at one of those seven schools that has a policy. So if you're at one of the others, help to get your school to adopt a policy, and then Harvard will help subsidize your fee-based open access journal publications. As I said, only 30% of open access journals are fee-based. 70% of them are not. The common understanding is that this is the only business model for open access. That's not true. It's not even the dominant model for open access. However, the 30% of journals that charge fees publish about half the papers that are published in open access journals, and they're growing at a rate that seems to be faster than the no-fee journals. So it's very likely that the journal that you think is best for your purposes will charge a fee. Don't be surprised. And don't fail to take advantage of the Hope Fund if you're at Harvard. Don't fail to take advantage of a similar fund at your institution if there is one. But you could skip them entirely, and you might skip them for a number of reasons. You might want to publish in a non-open access journal because the most prestigious journal in your field is non-open access, and you need the prestige for career advancement. That's okay. You can still make your work open access. A common misunderstanding is if you have to publish or if you choose to publish in a non-open access journal, that's it. You've given up on open access. Not true. You can publish in that sort of journal and still deposit your manuscript in an open access repository. Here's how to do that. First, you've got to find a suitable repository. There are two kinds. Those like DASH, which are associated with institutions, their mission is to capture the research output of that institution. DASH wants to capture all the journal articles published by Harvard faculty. There are disciplinary or subject-based repositories like Archive in Physics, like SSRN in the Social Sciences, like PubMed Central in Biomedicine. There may be a good disciplinary repository in your field. You need a repository where you have deposit rights. If you're not at Harvard, you don't have deposit rights in DASH. If you are at Harvard, you do. And by the way, by being at Harvard for this purpose, I mean if you have a valid Harvard ID. So a lot of you are Berkman Fellows, but not faculty. You are entitled to deposit in DASH, as long as you have a Harvard ID. That'll expire eventually. But while you're here, take advantage of it. You can deposit in DASH. Harvard students can deposit in DASH. But when you leave and go back to your home institution, look for a repository there, because you will have deposit rights there. you will have deposit rights in your subject matter or disciplinary repository because they're open to anybody who's in the field. But that's what I mean by a suitable repository. If you have no idea what repositories might be suitable, go to one of these directories, the Registry of Open Access Repositories or the Directory of Open Access Repositories. By the way, because of my clicking problems earlier on, I skipped right over this slide. I'm going to mention a bunch of resources, and I don't want you to have to write them down, and I didn't want to have to put URLs up on the screen and have you transcribe URLs. So all of that stuff is at this online handout. This is the only URL you have to write down. If you're listening in, it's just bit.ly/how-OA. Okay, where were we? See these resources, ROAR, OpenDoor, and Dash. All those are linked from the handout, so don't even bother to write them down. ROAR is a little bit more inclusive than OpenDoor. Today, ROAR is approaching 3,000 repositories across the world. It's a mix of institutional and disciplinary repositories. You will undoubtedly have deposit rights at least one of them. There are a couple universal repositories for people who don't have one in their field and don't have one in their institution. I go over those in the handout, but I don't think I mentioned them in the slides. This is the most important fact about green open access or open access through repositories. It's compatible most of the time with publishing in a non-open access journal. So if you need to publish in a non-open access journal, if it would be good for your career, go ahead and do it, and then deposit in a repository. Very few faculty understand this, and that's one reason why the deposits in repositories are as low as they are. Whether you choose gold or green, whether you choose to make your work open access through a journal or through a repository, the journal or repository needs permission, because if it's going to make your work open access, it doesn't want to violate anybody's copyright. This is where things get a little bit thick. The handout goes into the details more than I will on the slides, but I do want to go into some of them. As the author, you are the copyright holder when you finish writing the article. You have the right to transfer those rights to other people, and if you have not yet transferred them, you are the person, and you're the only person, who is authorized to permit open access. Sometimes you're in a position to authorize open access, and sometimes you're not, because sometimes you will already have transferred rights to somebody else, like a publisher. When that's happened, the situation is more complicated. For open access journals, we're assuming the paper has not already been published, which means you haven't yet transferred rights to anybody. You're still the sole copyright holder. You are the person authorized to permit open access. All you do is sign the publisher's contract. That's your way of saying, I authorize you to do this. That's easy. Making your work open access through an open access journal is exactly like publishing in a traditional journal. It just happens that the journal is open access. You submit it to them. They evaluate it. Maybe there's some back and forth as you revise it. Then you sign a contract allowing them to distribute it. In the case of a repository, it really depends on whether you've transferred your rights to someone else or not. Unrefereed preprints have not yet been published, so most of the time you will not already have transferred those rights. You're still the rights holder. You're still the one authorized to permit open access, so you can do this on your own. You can deposit your unrefereed preprints in Dash without asking anybody else's permission. But what if it's been published? What if it's been refereed? And refereed postprints is just a way of saying it's already undergone peer review. And if it has, chances are you've published it. And if you have, chances are you've transferred rights to somebody. I say chances are because publishing contracts differ. And sometimes you can publish and retain rights. Sometimes the publisher demands all rights. Some publishers demand more rights than others. So it's hard to generalize here. But if you have a peer-reviewed manuscript, chances are you've transferred rights to somebody else. On the other hand, here's where it gets interestingly complicated. Chances are your publisher permits green open access. A majority of subscription-based or non-open access publishers give standing permission to their authors to deposit the peer-reviewed manuscript in an open access repository. If I said the other thing was the best-kept secret, this is the second best-kept secret. Very few authors know this. You don't have to ask permission. You don't have to negotiate. The publisher gives standing permission, and it's not just the rare, exceptional, good citizen publisher. It's a majority. In order to know whether your publisher is one of those that has given standing permission, you have to read your contract with care. And if you don't want to do that, look up your publisher's policy in Sherpa Romeo, which, despite the inscrutable name, is the name of a database of publisher policies on precisely this point. You can look up policies by journal or by publisher. And the URL is in the online handout. note the version. When publishers give permission to deposit your peer-reviewed manuscript in an open access repository, they're not usually giving permission to deposit the published edition, the published PDF. By peer-reviewed manuscript, we mean the version that survived peer review. So if there was some back and forth in which you revised the language, it's the final language, the accepted language, that you're allowed to deposit. Now, for the purpose of scholarship, that's the one that really matters. This is the one which has been approved by peer review. But it doesn't have any subsequent copy editing that the journal might have done. It does not have pagination. So in that sense, it's not really citable. That if you want to quote something from a certain page, you've got to get the page number from the journal. And it doesn't have the journal's look and feel. So most of the time, you don't have permission to deposit the PDF itself or whatever form the publisher used. But you do have permission to deposit the peer-reviewed language. So, tip, from now on, for the rest of your career, whenever you publish in a peer-reviewed journal, save that version of the text. One of the hardest things about getting material into a repository is putting your hands on the right version, the version that you're allowed to deposit. Now, publishers are generally good about allowing deposit of that version, but authors are not very good about knowing where that version is. Now, I say most publishers give standing permission to deposit in a repository. What if your publisher doesn't? Then there are two things to do. You can ask. And this is difficult. Sometimes it's intimidating. Sometimes you don't even know exactly what to ask for. But you can ask. And some publishers who don't give standing permission for open access nevertheless agree to case-by-case requests. This was Elsevier's policy until 2004. It's not rare. Elsevier actually decided internally, when somebody asks us specifically for this article to become open access, we will always say yes. We're not going to give standing permission. We'll just always say yes. And then in 2004, they said, why don't we just give standing permission? So they did. I think that's how most publishers started to give standing permission. But many publishers are still in the case-by-case request stage, so don't hesitate to ask them. You should also not hesitate because you educate them about what authors want. It's a drag. It's a delay. It's negotiation. But one thing you should not worry about is having your already accepted paper rejected just because you asked. That's never happened. Or you can use an author addendum, and I'll just describe these briefly. It's a proposed contract modification. The contract doesn't give you permission to deposit in open access. That is what we're presupposing. But this addendum says, essentially, notwithstanding anything in the contract, the author is allowed to do that. You staple that onto the contract and you sign it. It's a proposed modification to the contract. Publishers can take it or leave it. But if you don't know what to ask for, if you're not a lawyer, if you don't know what rights would actually permit you to put the work in a repository, use an author addendum because they're written by lawyers in order to give you the rights that you actually need for this purpose. And some publishers are accustomed to seeing them, and so they don't have to study it closely. They'll just say, yes, our policy is to say yes to these or to say no to these. It's a proposal. It frees you from the need to negotiate. It frees you from the need to consult a lawyer, but it doesn't always work. Next thing, if your publisher does not give standing permission and you want standing permission for every one of your papers without depending on publishers, then get a Harvard-style policy at your institution. That's exactly what the Harvard-style policy does. It's not case-by-case permission. It's standing permission. It says from now on, every one of your papers may be deposited without copyright problems because you've already given the university the right to deposit them, and the university is simply exercising that right. Stuart and I can help you with your institution to develop this kind of standing permission. It's by far the best solution to the problem. Even if 60% of subscription publishers permit green open access without a case-by-case request, they could change their mind tomorrow, and there's always the 40% left over. This is the way to get it to 100% of your future publications and 100% of the research output of an institution. Once more, the online handout. And now we can take questions.
Frank Müller-Langer from the Max Planck Institute for Intellectual Property and Competition Law in Munich. Mm-hmm. There has recently been the introduction of hybrid open access journals in economics. Their authors can put their articles open access, but they have to pay a fee of $3,000.
Yes.
And so if the journals do not decrease their subscription fees at the same time, then it's some kind of double-dipping strategy of the commercial publishers.
Yes.
So my question would be, how do you believe this double-dipping could be mitigated?
We both abhor the double-dipping. The Harvard Fund, to pay fees on behalf of authors, will not pay fees at that kind of journal. That's one kind of disincentive. It's not changing the world very quickly. A lot of these journals still exist. In fact, my seat-of-the-pants judgment is that about half of hybrid journals are double-dippers. The ones that are not double-dippers, the ones that promise to reduce their subscription price in proportion to the uptake of their open access option, are conspicuous, because whenever they make that promise, they stand out from the crowd. Oxford is one, Springer is one. Oxford is exemplary in that it not only makes this promise, it actually publishes its data to prove that it's living up to its promise. It's actually the only one I know that does that. But apart from that, the only other way to curb that behavior is not to submit your work to them, or not to approve their option by taking advantage of it. A study published last year showed that the general uptake on hybrid journals across the board is only 2%. So it's not a very popular option. I think publishers adopted it in the first place because it was easy and low risk for them, and in some cases it was also double the money. That is, it was easy money, it was lucrative. They didn't take any of the risk that open access publishers take. But if there's no uptake, they're going to have to move on and look for something else. If the idea was to appease authors and say, look, we're really trying, that might have worked a couple years ago, but now it's clear they're not really trying, if that's all they're doing.
Such as the Max Planck Society, and I think also UC Berkeley, they signed pilot agreements with these publishers. So, and we analyzed the behavior of authors from these institutions, and there we could find that a significant number of authors actually chose this hybrid open access option. So, I think it's a real threat to the open access format. Exactly, yeah.
Right. So let me say a word about why the Harvard Open Access Fund doesn't pay fees for hybrid journals. The point of an open access fund of the sort that Harvard has, and I should say the Harvard Fund was responsive to a compact among a group of universities, initially five universities, Cornell, Dartmouth, Harvard, MIT, and Berkeley. Now it's expanded to another dozen, and I believe Max Planck is one of the signatories of this so-called Compact for Open Access Publishing Equity. The idea was to make a statement that we will support this alternative business model, this alternative revenue model for open access journals, namely publication fees, because we want... we want to make it clear that that's a preferable approach to scholarly publishing of articles. The goal is to support that business model. Paying hybrid fees not only doesn't support that revenue model for open access publications, because they're not open access publications, they're subscription publications that happen to have this policy. It's in fact a disincentive to the open access publication fee approach. Why? Because if a subscription journal is able to keep its subscription base, subscription revenue, and get those fees, it has no more incentive to switch over to replacing the subscription revenue with open access publication fees. So it's actually counterproductive for a fund of that sort to underwrite these hybrid fees. So what would be the good of underwriting the fees? Well, there is a good that's generated by underwriting a publication fee, a hybrid fee. And that is, you get open access to that one article. But at Harvard, we have a different way of getting open access to that one article. We have the rights to put it up in our repository. So my recommendation is, feel free to publish in journals that provide, subscription journals that provide this hybrid open access, just don't pay the fee and put your article in a repository. You save yourself $3,000 and you get open access to your article. Seems like a good bargain all around. That's the approach I would take. Now, it's not surprising to me if Max Planck or Berkeley or whoever is willing to underwrite those fees. Faculty are happy to say, sure, I'll spend your money to, if you want to introduce a moral hazard, I'll take advantage of it. But it doesn't seem like a very sensible approach in the law.
Can I just ask a follow-up question? Yeah. On the repository that you talked about, the Dash, you showed some downloads statistics for that. I was wondering where the downloads are coming from. You showed a map.
Yeah.
More than the countries I'm interested in, like whether they're coming from Google Scholar, whether it's you think it's Harvard people, whether they're coming from a proxy. So it's like people.
Well, so it's clearly not just Harvard people. That's for sure.
Okay.
It's certainly the case that downloads are not being generated because people are saying to themselves, I wonder what Harvard researchers have to say about such and such. I'll go to Dash, I'll search in Dash, and then I'll know what Harvard people say about that. That's not how things go. The reason people find articles in Dash is because Dash is indexed by lots of other harvesting services that are higher up on the web food chain, both academic search engines like Base and Oyster and Google Scholar, and more generic search engines like Google and Bing and so forth. And I think our figures are something like 60% of all, is that right? 60% of all hits on Dash are generated from Google. So that's how people are finding things. You know, all this stuff is very heavily indexed, not just the Harvard repository, but all the repositories. So that's where people are coming from. We, by the way, we provide a service called MyDash that allows you to get statistics of downloads in the various repositories. The public information is just aggregate statistics, but individual authors who have articles in Dash can get their own individual statistics for downloads, including these kinds of maps and download rates and so forth.
Thank you for the presentation. I have two questions. One is that one problem that I find from putting in a repository or something that incentivizes is that in the website of the journal appears the number of downloads. So, like my article that it's been like less downloaded than others because it's also available somewhere else, and this is a bit of a problem, I think. And then my question is, you have not mentioned putting the article into your website. I would like to know in which occasions we have the right to do it, and also why it's better like a repository and not your website, or how to combine it.
So the first question was about if you have an article in the repository, it may reduce the number of downloads at the publisher's site, and you get this nice download count from your publisher. So some publishers provide download counts, others don't. But in any case, the repository also can provide download counts, and Dash does. So you can track how many downloads you're getting in total. Of course, in the long run, what we would like to do is aggregate all those download counts. If you have it on your website, if you have it in the repository, you have it at the publisher's site, and so forth, you'd like to aggregate all those counts. And there have been efforts along these lines to set up, in fact, at Harvard we participated in one of these projects called Pyrrhus to aggregate download counts across publisher and repository sites. And I don't know what the current status of that is, but my hope would be that those projects would get sufficient support that they would continue.
I agree. Pyrrhus is incomplete or unfinished, but it's a good idea. And insofar as the split in the traffic data is a disincentive to deposit in a repository or a reason for a journal to refuse to let you deposit in a repository, then Pyrrhus can solve the problem. And we all have a reason in making it succeed. Quickly on your second question about personal websites, when you have permission to make the work open access, you can put it on your personal website in the same way that you could put it in a repository. However,
you shouldn't do it, or you should do it only as a last resort if you don't have deposit rights in a repository. The reason is that the repository will keep your work preserved and open even after you die, even after you change jobs, but your personal website will probably disappear in both those cases.
That doesn't mean it shouldn't be on your website. You can have it on your website as a link to the repository. In fact, that's what I do. I have a page on my website, lists all the publications, and for each one there's a link to the page on the repository where you can actually download that publication.
By the way, I do the same thing, so I don't want to appear to be a hypocrite. I do it because until I got to Harvard, I was not at an institution that had an institutional repository, and my field, philosophy, didn't have a disciplinary repository until just about the time I got to Harvard. So I had no choice except to put it on my personal website. And I already had everything listed, and after I started putting the same articles in Harvard, it was easier to keep the links on my website and add links to Dash because the Google juice was all pointing to my personal webpage. However, I expect that page to disappear eventually, but I don't expect Dash to disappear. Or at least I trust the longevity of Dash more than I trust the longevity of my personal page.
Is there any data about gender in open access, the balance of gender in open access type of journal in contrast to closed access type of journal? Because recently there has been published about how gender discrimination can be active even under peer review or...
You saw the latest JSTOR study that's in the news these days? As far as I know, they don't break anything down by open access versus closed, so they're not giving us the data that would answer your question. And I don't have an answer. I haven't seen data on that. Since I quit my job as a professor to work full-time on open access, I've worked at different nonprofits, and until I got to Harvard, every single one was run by a woman. That's anecdotal, doesn't tell you much about the field, but tells you this much.
So what's the JSTOR study?
JSTOR has access to data about millions of articles. And some scholars said, let's just look at how many articles were written by men, how many were written by women. Let's look at, and break that down by field. Let's look at how many papers with multiple authors put a woman in the first author position versus some other author position. It's a nice study. Nobody has apparently done that before. But JSTOR is not itself open access, even though it's moving slowly in that direction. So it doesn't have data about gender in open access itself. However, I recommend looking at the study. It's very interesting, and it's brand new. It also shows JSTOR is willing to allow certain kinds of text and data mining, which is new and important all by itself.
So a thought experiment. What about, imagine I'm in a university, and it's very likely that my university doesn't have that kind of open policies, and I would like my university to adopt those kind of policies. But geez, I'm alone, who do I contact? That sounds complicated. You know, what would be your advices for a place to start and keep the ball rolling on that side, in any kind of university?
It's a good question. It's a very tricky question. I don't know that there's general advice you can give about a particular tactic, but the one thing I would say is the most important thing to do is to find a champion on the faculty of the institution. It's quite likely you'll be able to find strong support among people in the library, librarians and others working in the library. And that's a good place to start, but you shouldn't stop there. You need to find faculty members, at least one faculty member, who's willing to champion the idea of promoting policies of various sorts towards open access. Peter, you?
I agree completely, and I also don't have more advice than that. Most policies since 2008, since the first Harvard policy, have been adopted by faculty as opposed to administrators. That's the trend. It's a good trend. Any new policy will be more effective if it's adopted by faculty and not perceived as an imposition from the administration. If it comes to a faculty vote, faculty have to perceive it as a faculty initiative that helps faculty. They can't perceive it as a power grab from the administration. Even, by the way, when it's faculty initiative, it is sometimes perceived as a power grab from the administration. So these are reasons why we have to be very sensitive about this, make sure that the leadership is identified as faculty. Faculty have to do the knocking on doors. Stuart is the one who knocked on the doors here. But how you get started from zero when there's not already some movement, some leadership, some education, I don't really know. However, Harvard is a model policy, which we recommend as a template. Stuart and I just released last week a guide to good practices for university open access policies, and it says in great detail what the model policy says briefly. So when you approach other faculty, or when you prepare to approach other faculty, it is a way of answering your questions in advance, preparing you for the inevitable questions you'll get from faculty, the inevitable misunderstandings. And it explains why some schools have made this choice rather than that choice.
That good practices guide is presumably linked.
I linked to it from here.
From there.
But the URL is just as easy. It's bit.ly/goodOA with no I.
So there's another question you might have asked but didn't, but it's related, which is what if you're an institution that might have a policy for faculty, but you're not a faculty member? Why do the policies only cover faculty? And at Harvard, we only covered faculty because it was a faculty body that voted the policy. So if we're imposing a policy on ourselves, it's only the scope of the body that's voting. But we've had people say, well, maybe graduate students write a lot of scholarly articles, maybe they should have a policy that applies to them. And it's an interesting question as to whether there could be a similar general policy of that sort. Who would be the body that would vote for the graduate students in, let's say, Graduate School of Arts and Sciences here? What body would vote that, and what would be the mechanism by which that vote would really have force in causing licenses to be granted? It's an interesting question. And there, similarly, just as you want a faculty member to be spearheading the effort to launch a faculty-voted policy, you'd want graduate students to be spearheading their efforts to set up graduate student policy or postdocs or postdoc policy or whatever, however that works.
Thank you. Apologies if you already covered this in your main presentation. My question is about open access to research data. And one of the arguments for open access to publications is that you can then link the publications, the data, make both of them discoverable, one from the other. What are you seeing happening at Harvard and elsewhere in terms of the open access to data, as far as the data management plans, NSF, and so on, as an argument, and to what extent is one driving the other?
That's a very good question. It didn't come up earlier. And there's a couple issues there. There's a question about data management plans, and then there's a question about how to actually, if you want to make your data open access, how to do that. Data management plans is mandated by various funding agencies now, NSF and I think several others, don't necessarily require that you make your data openly available, although there's certainly encouragement along those directions. There isn't, I don't know of any institutional response to this increase in requirements for data management plans at Harvard. I think it's being handled on a relatively ad hoc way at the moment. The office, various offices of sponsored research that the schools have made have various efforts. But there's certainly a very good method for providing data openly at Harvard, and that is to use Harvard's Dataverse Network, which is an open source system for, essentially it's a repository for data, just as Dash is, which is built on DSpace, is a repository for articles. Many universities have set up Dataverse, but it was IQSS at Harvard that actually developed it, and it's a wonderful repository, as very good, very specialized support for distributing data and providing information about the underlying data. So the best practice there would be to put the article in Dash, the data in Dataverse, and then link each one to the other. And again, just like Dash, Dataverse is available to anyone at Harvard. I'm not sure, did that answer the questions?
It did. So you are you actively building those links, or are you just encouraging people to build them?
A lot of those links, but we won't know to link a particular data set to a particular article unless someone tells us. I'm looking over at some of the OSC people to verify that I'm speaking correctly.
A follow-up comment on this one. Assume a young scholar creates a data set, and it's time-consuming, and so then what would be the incentive to voluntarily share the data if, for instance, the researcher could use the data for a second or even a third publication? So how could institutions set incentives for researchers to share the data?
Yeah, so this is why open access to data is a more fraught issue than open access to research articles. There's no incentive for an author of a research article not to provide it as openly as possible. But there could be a perceived incentive to keep the data under wraps. It's unclear to what extent the worries are real or just perceived, but it doesn't matter. If people perceive them, then people will want to keep data closed. And I don't have Peter may have a good general answer there, but you were talking about what incentives. It's hard to imagine incentives that a university could apply in this area without starting to infringe academic freedom. But it's easy to imagine policies that funders could apply.
And journals.
And journals could apply.
The growing number of journals are saying, if you publish with us a piece of research based on data, the data set has to be open on the day of publication.
I'm an economist. The top 10 economics journals, they have introduced a data availability policy.
Yeah.
So you can only publish your paper there if you submit your data.
Yeah.
So this could be a way forward.
You submit your data, or you also have to agree to make it openly available if
it's,
the article is published?
It's openly available on the, for instance, American Economic website. But
yes.
This only works for the most prestigious journals, because there the value of a publication is so high that even young scholars, they submit the data. But
they're also breaking the ice. They're creating a precedent, and they're spreading the meme. This idea will spread. Essentially, no journals did this 5 years ago, and now the best journals are doing it. Publishers endorsed open data long before they endorsed open access, and that's because they never published data, they never held copyright in data, they never made money from data, so it's no skin off their nose if data is open. That's still their position, so they have everything to gain and nothing to lose by encouraging open data, by requiring open data. That's why I think it will keep spreading. It's difficult sometimes for authors, and in the open data movement, one of the hard questions is timing. Do you really want to force authors to make it available the very day they publish their first article based on the data, or do you want to let them publish 5 articles on the data before they make it open, or if not 5, N? What's N? This is a hard question.
But for those cases where, I mean, you're right, some journals may not have an incentive. They may not think they have an incentive. But then, of course, if a funding agency says you have to do it, it doesn't matter whether the journal requires it or not. As a researcher, you're going to do it, and the funding agencies have a big carrot to hold out, namely, if you don't agree to make the data available, you don't get our money.
Another one of the hard issues in open data goes to the incentive question. There are projects working on data attribution. So when you publish a data set and share it openly, no matter where the data ends up, people can tell that it's yours, or that you generated the data. Data attribution is complicated technically, first of all. Even if you wanted to do it, it's hard to implement. It's also difficult in other ways. One purpose of open data is to allow the integration of data sets that were not created at the same time by the same people. So if you did a small sample study and somebody else did a small sample study, wouldn't it be nice to merge them and get a large sample study? Well, that presupposes some levels of interoperability. And if we can actually establish that, then it's beneficial. But then if we have a data attribution requirement built in,
John Wilbanks uses the term attribution stacking. After a certain point, you might have to attribute the data to 40,000 people because that's how many data sets have been integrated in your set. That's why he disapproves the idea of data attribution and prefers the public domain with no CC BY, no attribution requirement. But others think we need attribution precisely to give authors an incentive to make their work open. What's your incentive? Well, you'll get credit for it, just the way you get credit for your publications without getting money. If you got credit without money for data, you might have the same reason to share it that you have for sharing articles. Maybe. It's still untested because data attribution is so difficult to work out. But there are projects working on it, and while they're working, people are fighting about whether it's wise.
Is there one last question, maybe?
I have a question for either or both of you. Do you think that we're at a tipping point for open access? Do you think we're past it, or is it just around the corner?
Tipping point for open access? From your mouth to God's ear. You know, finding the point where the knee in an exponential curve is, that's a very hard task. I wouldn't hazard a guess. Peter, how did you?
I don't like the word tipping point, even though I've used it a couple times, because it implies there's a point. If we get past the idea of points, there's still such a thing as irreversible progress. I think we have that. We have irreversible momentum. Even the publishers who strongly disapprove the idea and spend millions to lobby against it have accommodated it. Entire governments are mandating it. That's not going to change. That's not going to reverse anytime soon. So we're moving toward a world in which open access will become the default for new research in more and more fields for more and more people. If there's a tipping point, it would be something like this. If it's true that 20% of the scholars publish 80% of the articles, and something like that is true, even if those aren't the exact numbers, then all you need is the right 20%. If there, you know, some percentage of them are at Harvard and some are at other schools that have similar policies and the rest are funded by the NIH, then you get that 20% by virtue of a small number of policies without converting the whole world. That's what we're moving close to very quickly. And when that 20% is making its work open access, everybody else will follow, and if they take their time, we don't even care. That is, when we get to the point where 80% of the work is open access, we've won. And the rest is just mopping up.
So I think Stuart and Peter will stick around for a few minutes for questions afterwards, but thank you so much.